You're listening to Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock.
Big John McCarthy has witnessed the best that the UFC had to offer.
That is it! Game, set, match! We have a new champion!
Your backstage pass to the world of mixed martial arts and combat sports. Only on the Ignotainment Media Network.
Let's get it on!
Hey everyone, welcome to Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and me, Sean Wheelock. Every week on this podcast, John and I give you an inside look at MMA and combat sports, always separating fact from fiction. On this week's program, we'll examine the situation of John Jones' arrest and his subsequently being stripped of the UFC light heavyweight title by Dana White. Big John and I will also break down the Ben Askren versus Luis Santos fight from last week's ONE Championship in the Philippines, which devolved into arguably the biggest debacle in MMA this year. Plus, we'll look ahead to the Floyd Mayweather Jr. versus Manny Pacquiao fight and discuss its place in the history of boxing's most hyped bouts. And as we do on every episode of Let's Get It On, John will answer your questions. So ask away via email, info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Again, that's info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Remember that you can download and subscribe to our podcast on the iTunes Store. For Android, download the Stitcher app and subscribe. And you can go straight to our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. On Tuesday, Dana White announced that John Jones has been stripped of his UFC light heavyweight title and suspended indefinitely from fighting in the organization, following the arrest of Jones the day before for felony hit and run in New Mexico. Then on Wednesday, Reebok announced that they had terminated their endorsement contract with Jones, who is currently free on $2,500 bond. John, we'd like to talk about the positive things in MMA and combat sports, controversies in the cage, but this is a story you just simply can't ignore, because after probably Ronda Rousey, John Jones is the biggest star in our sport right now, and this is a very unfortunate situation all the way around.
It's absolutely unfortunate. You know, when you're looking at John, you're looking at arguably the greatest mixed martial arts fighter there's ever been. You know, you can look at Anderson Silva and everything that he did, and you know, John may not have acquired the amount of victories and as a champion that Anderson has, but he is absolutely the king when it comes to the light heavies, and he's probably the king of the pound for pound. And there's no one that you're looking at. You know, you can look at Anthony Rumble Johnson, has got a chance. Everyone has a chance, but every time someone steps into the cage with John Jones, he's absolutely the favorite to win the fight, and you almost expect it to happen based upon his, you know, past. And what's going on with John is really it's sad, and it's sad because, you know, people don't look at and understand sometimes the pressures that come with being champion, and sometimes being 27 years old, you think you know everything. You know, I know when I was young, I thought I was so smart and I was so stupid and I made so many stupid decisions, and John's making some really stupid decisions, and he needs to grow up. He needs to get his, you know, proverbial shit together and figure out he's blowing it. You know, last week you came up with the great line from Angelo Dundee about the Sugar Ray Leonard, Thomas Hearns fight, and it's, you're blowing it, son, you're blowing it. And you know what? John's blowing it, and he needs to get his act together.
John, this is unprecedented in terms of the 21-and-a-half-year history of the UFC. A champion has never been stripped of his or her title before for disciplinary reasons. There have been champions who've jumped to other organizations, like Pride have been stripped. A lot of different issues. They've been suspended. There have been interim champions. But there's never been anything like this John Jones situation. Again, totally unprecedented.
You know, it is unprecedented, but, you know, I commend the UFC. I commend Dana White, Lorenzo Fertitta, you know, Lawrence Epstein, the attorney COO of the company. This is not an easy decision to make, but this is a decision you're making not even based so much upon what's right for your company, which I think it's right for their company. You're trying to make a decision on what's right for the individual. And like I said, that the weight of that title weighs heavily. You know, it's the weight of the crown weighs heavily upon the king's head, and he is the king. And if you've never been there, it's hard to understand. It's hard to understand what it's like for, you know, a 25, 26, 27-year-old man to have people coming up to him all the time, telling him how great he is, how wonderful he is, what he does is so cool, giving him things. All of it starts to become overwhelming. And it takes a special individual to be able to realize, you know what? I'm not special. I'm no different than anybody else. I can't play by different rules. I need to play by the same rules as everyone else out there. I put my pants on one leg at a time. And because people think I'm so special because I fight, that's great. But I need to look in the mirror and understand what I'm looking at every time I do. And that's something that when you get all these things coming your way, seems like it's going to last forever. It's not. And you need to start doing the right things with your life and with your career that are going to keep you financially successful for the rest of your life, because your moment of making money is now. It's not going to be forever. And things are going to change. And you have to start looking at the future in the right way and understanding it is going to change. And what do I need to do to prepare myself and my family for that future? And right now, John's just not, he's living in the present. He's, you know, he's doing things that, you know, I can't blame him. I can't blame anyone as a 27-year-old man, you know, not making the perfect decisions. But I know that John Jones was raised by a good family. I know he knows right from wrong. And I know that he's putting himself in positions that are causing him to make poor choices. And that's his fault. And he's the one that's got to remedy it. And he's the one that has got to look in the mirror and say, it's got to stop. And there's only one person that can do that, and that's him. He can ask for all the help in the world, and there's people there that will help him. But he's got to acknowledge, I can't do this anymore.
Because as we mentioned, this is unprecedented in the history of the UFC. And I believe that MMA, as we know, it began with the first UFC, November 12th, 1993. So it's unprecedented, really, in the history of our sport. Let's first talk about what a civil libertarian would say. And I'm not subscribing to this view, but John, you're in a unique position, not just as the greatest MMA referee of all time, but you were a uniformed officer for the Los Angeles Police Department. You're a retired officer, as our viewers, our listeners may not know. So you have a different insight, not just the MMA insight, but the law and order insight. So a civil libertarian would say, what happened to innocent until proven guilty? How can you be stripped of your title? How can you be suspended from making a living if you've only been charged? Then, as far as I know, it hasn't even been pushed forward yet from the district attorney's office. He's pled guilty and he's bonded out. That's the state. How would you answer that? Again, I'm not subscribing to that. I'm just throwing up a counter argument. I'm not throwing the civil libertarian view out there.
You know, look at it. The civil libertarian is going to sit there and he's going to say, well, you know, what happened to due process of law? This has nothing right now to have to do with due process of law. This has to do with, there is an athlete who signs a contract. When he signs the contract to fight for that company, that promotion, there's criteria in it, and it has nothing to do with the legal system of the United States of America. It has to do with the policies and procedures of that company that he agrees to. And the UFC as a company has to look at, their champions need to represent not only themselves in the proper way, they need to represent the company, the UFC, in the proper way. That is their obligation as the champion, to take MMA and take the UFC and put it in a good light. And, you know, within their contracts, they have certain codes of conduct that the fighters need to oblige by. And, you know, when you're looking at what's going on with John, he's not following that contract, and they have every right to discipline him, to terminate him if they wanted, to take away a title, in that title is not a right of John Jones. It's a privilege. It's a privilege he earns, and he did earn it in the cage. and he has earned it over and over again every time he has faced someone in competition. But with that title comes responsibilities, and John is not upholding his end of those responsibilities. And the UFC has the absolute right to take that title from him at this time, because I'm telling you, they're taking a weight off of his shoulders. You know, there's going to be people out there saying, oh my God, that's so wrong. You're stripping him. He's the champion. You shouldn't do that. Bull. They should do it. They should take it. They should take the pressure of being the champion off of him right now, because obviously it's overwhelming his decision-making process. And let's get it to where he doesn't have the pressure of being the champion. He doesn't have the pressure of even worrying or thinking about a fight. He's suspended indefinitely. And until, you know, as basic as you can say it, until you get your shit together, we're not going to have you fight for our promotion, because obviously at this moment in your life, you have too many things going on that you can't deal with in the proper fashion. So we're going to say that, you know, this portion of your life, your fighting life right now, it's over. It's over until you get all this other stuff taken care of. And you can look at it in the libertarian and say, oh, then you know what? He hasn't been proven guilty. He doesn't have to be proven guilty. He's guilty as far as he ran from the scene of a crime. He created that crime. He hurt a woman that was a pregnant woman, and pregnant or not, he broke her arm and ran away from it. That is not the responsibility of an upstanding citizen. An upstanding citizen can make a mistake. There can be an accident. But when you create that accident, you have a responsibility to do the right things. You have the responsibility to call 911. You have the responsibility to get an ambulance and paramedics there to help this person that you caused injury to. Those are the things that we expect out of any citizen, out of any fighter. And when we have someone that's not doing those things and doing exactly the wrong thing, and John knows why he did it, this has nothing to do with the accident itself. I think there's other things involved in here that, you know, John needs to, you know, own up to and figure out. I can't control what's going on. This is controlling me, and that's the problem. And it's making me come up with bad choices. And the consequences that are occurring off of those bad choices are things that I can't have anymore, so I need to fix this. And, you know, this has nothing to do with the Constitution of the United States. This has to do with he signed a contract. In that contract, he has responsibilities. He's not meeting those responsibilities, and they're going to take care of it.
We know that all of you listening feel very strongly one way or the other on this issue with John Jones, which leads us to this week's poll question. Remember, cast your vote on our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. So our poll question for this week's episode, do you feel that Dana White was correct in his decision to strip John Jones of the UFC light heavyweight title? Vote yes or no at letsgetitonpodcast.com. John, another issue when you look at suspensions, and we're seeing a lot of suspensions now in MMA. You think about Alexander Shlemenko. You think about Hector Lombard. There is an appellate process. And again, because this is a morals clause, but if John Jones had tested positive for, say, androstenedione or elevated levels of epitestosterone to testosterone, he's going to have an appellate process for his license through the Nevada State Athletic Commission or the California State Athletic Commission or whomever the regulatory body is. No appellate process here.
No, there's no appellate process here, because look at John isn't being punished by a state regulatory body. He's not being punished by the Nevada State Athletic Commission, who he was supposed to be fighting for, you know, here in the middle of May. He's being punished by his boss. He's being punished by the person that he has a contract with, that he signed the contract with, that he agreed to all of the terms of that contract by, you know, putting his name down on that paper. He's saying that I agree to these terms. You know, those are the same terms that he agrees to as far as them paying him a certain amount of money and all those things. And, you know, when you look at what we have here, this is two different, you know, sets of circumstances. When, you know, Alexander Shlemenko gets caught with high levels in his TE ratio, that is him doing something that is against the statutes of the California State Athletic Commission. He has exceeded the TE ratio that is allowed under the California State Athletic Commission for a competitor to compete at. And so they have the right to look at what that ratio is and come up with a penalty, a fine, a time of suspension. All of that is based upon him doing something that is outside of what they say is fair competition. What John is doing, and we're talking about legal, in breaking, you know, the laws of the state of New Mexico, you know, and this goes beyond just, you know, what is occurring when you look at Hector Lombard or Alexander Shlemenko. That's a breach of etiquette within the rules of a sport. John's breaking laws, and John needs to, you know, get himself right. You know, the one thing I want to say is, I hope John learns from this. I hope he wises up. I hope he gets, you know, mature counsel in telling him, you know what, you need to change. You need to figure out you are a phenomenal athlete. And on top of being a phenomenal athlete, you're just a person. And you're a person that's making choices that are going to affect your life, your wife's life, your kids' lives in a negative fashion. And since you have the power to be the one to keep that from happening, start making good choices. Start being an adult and start getting yourself right.
John, you really hit on something with the morals clause. Every contract that I've signed with a national outlet or international outlet as a commentator, including my current one on my Spike Bellator deal, it's boilerplate. It's not written, thankfully, specifically for me, but it's boilerplate. I'm sure Bob Costas and Al Michaels have the same thing. It's that morals clause that they can terminate on that. When I was at ESPN, I had it. When I was at Fox Sports International, I have it. I'm sure I'm always going to have it. It's just standard boilerplate contract. I've never seen a UFC contract. I've never even seen a Bellator fighter contract, but I imagine they're always put in there. And it's probably outside of the scope of sports and television. I imagine there are a lot of companies for employees at will, and John Jones is an employee at will. He's not a salaried employee, that there is that morals clause. So that supersedes due process or this actually running its way through the court system.
Yeah, look at any company that signs someone, you know, based upon their talents, their skills. You know, you can look at, you know, John with his Reebok contract. He just lost his Reebok contract. That's because Reebok is looking at it saying, I don't want to be associated with someone who is going to end up in a situation where they do the wrong thing. You know, end up in a situation. He has an accident. It's an accident. Now, maybe the accident was caused by things that John shouldn't have been doing in the first place. And so that kind of takes the accident part a little bit away. But we'll say that it was an accident. And, you know, he makes the decision, instead of to do the right thing, to call for help, to help somebody that he has brought undue injury to, he decides to take off and run like a child. That we can't have. I can't have my brand associated with an individual that is going to make that kind of decision and possibly embarrass my company. This is it's a statute that is out there in contracts everywhere you go. And even in, you know, when you're looking at certain job types, you look at a fireman, you look at a policeman, they know there's verbiage in their ability to keep that job as far as their personal conduct, what they can do and what they can be suspended for based upon that conduct.
John, last point on this. There's been so much talk in the NFL. I realize we have a lot of listeners outside of the U.S. and Canada, but bear with me as we talk about gridiron American football. But in the NFL, under Commissioner Roger Goodell, they have the personal conduct policy. So if this were an NFL player, and we saw it last year, look at Ray Rice, look at Adrian Peterson, but because they're unionized, there's going to be an advocate on your side. Even an individual sport like men's tennis, the ATP, where they have drug suspensions, which do happen from time to time, they're unionized. There's no such thing as a fighter's attorney. No, there's not that natural appellate process. But that's a fair comparison, because what if John Jones has this exact same situation, but like his brother, he's an NFL player. Now, he's still going to be dropped by Reebok. There's no doubt about it. But it runs its way differently through the employers. Again, an employee at will, but that union factor makes this a different, at least scenario initially. I don't know if the suspension is going to be dealt out that quickly.
Well, I mean, you can say it's a different scenario. And of course, if there's a union behind you, it is a different scenario, but it's going to be the same result. You know, I don't give a dang if you've got the NFLPA behind you or if you've got Major League Baseball's union behind you. When you are in the wrong, there's nothing anyone can say for you. John knows he was wrong. Everyone that's associated with John knows he's wrong and he needs to change. And, you know, there's many times people get away with doing things based upon legalities. And in those legalities, sometimes, you know, it's that the, you know, the officers, the investigation, they went past what they're legally able to do, even though what they were doing was getting the information to prove that this person was wrong. And we'll get a lawyer that will get their client off based upon a legality. The difference here is John's not going to be able to get away with the legalities when it comes to the UFC. The UFC has his contract, and in his contract, it has clear verbiage that says what is expected of him under that code of conduct. He read it. He knows it. Or if he didn't read it, his management and lawyer that he has go through it, read it, and accepted it. And he needs to start doing things like the world champion needs to do them. He needs to do things. He needs to set an example. You know, I'm not saying, you know, that goes back to the old Charles Barkley thing. You know what? I'm not your role model. You know what? You are. I don't give a damn if you want to accept the role. But when you start stepping on that court, or you start stepping on that field, or you start stepping in that cage, and you start doing what you do as a professional athlete, there are people that are going to want to associate with you. There are people that are going to want to be you. There are people that are going to fantasize about what you do. And it's a responsibility that maybe you didn't sign up for in theory, but you signed up for it. And you need to start doing things in the proper way to represent the sport of MMA in the right light. You need to start representing your promotion, the UFC, in the right light. And you need to start representing yourself, John Jones, in the right light.
John, that's really well said. Well, of course, every week on this podcast, John and I answer your questions, which are consistently excellent. Keep them coming. Email us info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Again, email us info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Of course, I always implore you to please include instructions on how to pronounce your name correctly. Unless you're our first questioner, Jay, no last name given. John, easy, unless he's from Brazil, then it would probably be Jay. But Jay. I'm going with Jay because he didn't say he was from Brazil or Portugal. So Jay, no last name, asks, John, is there any data from the new Bellator gloves and them reducing eye pokes? And as a caveat to this, a lot of people have noticed that under Scott Coker's mandate, great decision, we're doing in Bellator what Coker had done in Strikeforce. Blue gloves, blue corner, red gloves, red corner, and they're a redesigned glove. I know the outstanding cut man, Dean Lassiter, worked with Everlast in working on these gloves. Two things. It's trying to reduce eye pokes and then try to reduce hand fractures.
Yeah, you know, all right. It's a good question, and there's a couple of parts to it. And, you know, I'll make it real clear. When Scott Coker came in and took over Bellator, he did bring in that red and blue gloves. And so they went to Everlast and they said, hey, we want to get red and blue. And Everlast changed the gloves. And I will tell you, as soon as I saw the gloves, I went to Corey Schaefer and said, what have you guys done here? What are they giving you? Because the gloves were wrong. In fact, they went back to the old stitching that was part of the problem when Vitor Belfort fought Randy Couture. He cut his eyelid, you know, in a horizontal fashion across his eyelid, and it stopped a world title fight in 40-some seconds based upon the equipment being defective. It was stitched together in a way that left a hard edge. And when the Everlast gloves came, all of a sudden, they had that same hard edge. And I go, you know, you can't do this. You can't have these guys fighting with these gloves. And they went right away back to Everlast, and Everlast has now fixed that problem. But the glove itself does force the fingers down. And it's a good thing. And we get, you know, I get fighters out of Bellator sometimes. Kleber Luciano came up to me and he goes, he says, look, I can't even really open my hand. And I looked at him and said, good. I'm glad. I don't want you to be able to take and put your fingers out forward. So I don't think that we have any true clinical type of information yet on, is the glove really keeping eye pokes out? But I will tell you, you know, just off of doing, you know, shows everywhere and the different types of gloves, I think we will still get eye pokes in Bellator, but I do think that we're getting less. I haven't seen the same amount in Bellator, and I think, you know, that glove, in trying to force the fingers down and make it to where it's easy to close the hand, but you have to really work to extend the hand, is a good thing. It's working, and I think Bellator is kind of setting the example of the way the gloves need to be for the future. And I think there's still changes that need to be made with the gloves. Bellator at least is setting that standard of trying to do something to make this better for the fighters, for the fans, and for the sport. And I applaud what they're doing. You know, again, nothing's going to ever be perfect, but we've got to always work to try to make things better.
Next up, Steve Berg, who asked, John, have you ever officiated a fight that you wanted to stop yet weren't able to by the standard rules? Steve continues, I ask this because in his fight versus Luke Rockhold, Lyoto Machida seemed to be badly hurt between rounds, and as a big Machida fan, I was hoping for a corner stoppage or a towel throw.
Great question, Steve, and absolutely. You know, a referee looks at the fight completely different than a fan looks at the fight. He looks at it different than the fighters are looking at it. I'm there to try to allow people to come in and do damage to each other. And they're going to do damage to each other. That's part of fighting. But I'm there to try to make sure that the fighter doesn't sustain what I call unnecessary harm. And there's many times when you get a guy or a girl that's in there and they're fighting. I mean, they're fighting with everything they have. It's just that everything they have does not match up in any fashion to the person that they're competing against at this time. And they just, every exchange that you're watching, they get the worst of it. Every grappling situation, they get the worst of it. The pace of the fight is going in a fashion that you can see that they are unable to run at that RPM at the same way that their opponent is. And they're just pushing so hard that their body is shutting down. And, you know, I can tell you that it's very difficult to be in the ring with two fighters that are fighting, and one is fighting as hard as they can, and you see that they're losing. And they know they're losing. They know that they cannot effectively compete with their opponent, but they're not going to quit. They're not going to stop. They're going to go to the very end. And it's tough to, you know, be in there and to watch them when you know you're thinking to yourself, you know, for the corner, you know, let's get this guy out of here. Let's get this girl out of here. Let's take care of them. And you know the corner's not going to throw the towel. Corners just don't throw towels because, for the most part, they believe in their fighter. They believe that, oh, they've got that one chance. They believe that they're going to make this comeback fighter. And he would throw the towel as soon as he realized my guy doesn't have it tonight. And I loved John Hackelman, loved the way he took care of his people. And we as officials cannot rely upon corners doing the right thing because they believe in their people. But many times I would love to stop fights, and I've got to let them go because the person is fighting, and it's hard. It's a hard thing to do, but it would be really nice, but we would have a lot of people mad at us. So we let it go to the point until we can actually say the person was not intelligently able to defend themselves, and that's why I stopped the fight. And when they're fighting back, you're not able to say that.
On then the Susan Walker, John, I'm going to warn you, this is going to be a very slippery slope. This is a dangerous question from Susan, who's a great
Jeez,
fan of
thanks.
Our program and of MMA. So
thanks,
you've been
Susan,
forewarned.
Thanks, Sean, for reading it.
Women MMA fighter Susan writes, always seem to bring it. Even when they know they have won the first two rounds and could stay out of danger in the third, they still seem to always go for the finish. Here we go now, John. John, do you think women go for it the way they do because they feel they need to prove themselves more than men? Uh-oh.
You know, I do think that women in some ways do feel that they have to prove themselves. I don't know if they think they have to prove themselves more than men, but they have to prove themselves to everybody that they are real fighters, that they are technically good, that they do the right things. And I think that, you know, overall, that's what's made women's MMA what it is that they have proved themselves. You know, the real thing, I was talking about this just the other day when I was teaching up in Seattle, Washington, is women's MMA and the reasons it's working is because it mimics the men's MMA so well. And when I say mimics it, what I'm saying is that in MMA, men throw punches, they throw kicks, they throw knees, they grapple, they do submissions, and all of that can end the fight. And with women's MMA, it mimics it incredibly well compared to what women's boxing did. Because in boxing, what we have is, you know, look at everything is, you know, physics. And truthfully, women cannot punch like a man can punch. When you take a trained athlete and you put a woman's punch against a man's punch at the same weight, there is a difference. Now, there's always going to be that woman that can punch. She just punches harder than other women. Ann Wolfe in boxing was one of those women. You know, Ann Wolfe is just a different type of woman structure. She's kind of like the Chris Cyborg for MMA. Chris Cyborg just punches at a different level than other girls. And, you know, when you're in the cage with her and you see her hit another girl, you see the reaction from her opponent like, oh, my God, because they've never been hit by another woman the way that Chris ends up hitting him. And so when it came to women's boxing, there, you know, Layla Ali, Christy Martin, all of these females were out there, you know, fighting, and they fight with a good technical skill. It's just that inevitably the viewer got to the point where they realized every time I'm going to watch a female boxing match, it's going to go to the decision. If it's an 8-round fight, it's going to go 8 rounds. If it's a 10-round fight, it's going to go 10 rounds. And they realized that women, just for the most part, didn't have the ability to have that one punch knockout power. And in many cases, even in multiple attacks, were unable to do enough damage to put their opponent away. Again, always going to be the exceptions, like the Ann Wolfe, who could, with a punch, put someone out. But first off, they do have smaller gloves, so that punching power is increased. On top of that, they have heavier tools. And when I say heavier tools, when you're looking at it, when a girl's punching, you know, with her left hand or right hand, you're looking at her like using a 22 caliber weapon. It's a small weapon. It can hurt, but it doesn't carry a lot of power or force or torque behind it. But our girls can use kicks. Their legs are heavier and they carry more torque, more velocity. They can use knees. Knees are like a 45, especially with a girl, because they're heavy. They're short, heavy, and they come up and they carry that weight, which can put another girl out. And then we have the submission part. You look at someone like a Ronda Rousey, and what she's able to do with submissions makes it to where everyone knows when they watch Ronda Rousey, it's not a question of, is this going to go the distance? It's a question of, when is it going to end, is the way they're looking at it. And so that's what women's MMA has done, is it's been able to mimic that our girls are going to finish fights. It's not going to be that every time we see them, it's going to go to a decision. Our girls finish fights. And on top of finishing the fights, they're always working towards finishing the fights. Even when they've won the first 2 rounds of a 3-round fight, they're still going after it, trying to put their opponent away in the 3rd round. They don't hold back. And that has what has made women's MMA really catch on with the general public.
Great questions per usual. Keep them coming. Email us whatever you'd like to ask Big John. info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. That's info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Still to come on this week's episode of Let's Get It On, John and I will examine the Ben Askren versus Luis Santos fight in ONE Championship, which resulted in disorganization, indecision, and a lot of people standing around with seemingly no idea what to do next. And we'll look ahead to Mayweather versus Pacquiao by discussing boxing's biggest fights of the previous 5 decades. With Big John McCarthy, I'm Sean Wheelock, and you are listening to Let's Get It On. It's the book that Wrestling Observer calls a must-read for any MMA fan. Jonathan Snowden of Bleacher Report describes as riveting and amazing, and thefightnerd.com says nothing is held back. Pick this book up right away. Is This Legal? The inside story of the first UFC from the man who created it, written by UFC founder Art Davey and me, Sean Wheelock, with the foreword by John McCarthy, is now available to listeners of this podcast at the special price of $12.48. That's far less than you'll pay for the book on Amazon and half price of what you'll pay in-store at Barnes & Noble. Buy it directly from the publisher now online at ascendbooks.com and enter the promo code LEGAL50. That's ASCENDbooks.com, promo code LEGAL50. Learn the true story of how the UFC came into existence in the book that Randy Couture describes as honest, shocking, and enthralling, and that has a rating of 4.9 out of 5 stars from Amazon Reader Reviews. Is This Legal? The inside story of the first UFC from the man who created it by UFC founder Art Davey and me, Sean Wheelock, with the foreword by Big John McCarthy. Available now online at ascendbooks.com for just $12.48 when you use the promo code LEGAL50.
For all of our listeners looking for great new designs in MMA apparel, look to the new clothing styles of Lambs to Lions. That's right, Lambs to Lions has got new styles with old and new put together. Boxing, MMA, everything. Go to lambstolionsbrand.com and check out their line of clothing.
Hey, this is Sean Wheelock.
And this is Big John McCarthy.
If you're a fan of our show, then you're going to love the rest of the Ignotainment podcast lineup.
Like the Ocho Man Behind the Eight Ball and the Whiskey Philosopher with Jeff Cooper.
You can find these great podcasts and more at Ignotainment.com. Thanks again and enjoy the rest of the program.
Let's get it on!
Now, back to Let's Get It On with your hosts, Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock.
Last Friday in the Philippines, ONE Championship, the MMA promotion formerly known as ONE FC held their latest card with Ben Askren versus Luis Santos in the main event. What unfolded, though, John, was disorganization and indecisiveness that quickly moved from laughable to outright embarrassing.
It was an interesting 12 minutes of time, basically. You know, you look at that and you look at the promotion, and they put on a really good show, and they try what's done in Asia and, you know, throughout, you know, let's say, you know, the Philippines, where that was at, Singapore, into Japan. It's MMA is different, and what they do is different. The rules are different. The officials are going to be different. They do things in a different way. They do things in a more theatrical way towards pro wrestling. They end up following rule sets that are different than what we have here in, you know, North America, and what we're basically trying to establish in different countries like Brazil and going into Poland and all these other places that, you know, they're trying to bring about the unified rules everywhere. You know, when you go to Australia, it's the unified rules. When you go to England, it's the unified rules. It doesn't matter where you're going. We're trying to get everyone to incorporate the same rule set so the fighters are used to what's going on, the fans are used to it, and there's no change. When you go to Asia, it's a little bit different, and ONE FC runs things different. And the other difference is the officials are employees of, you know, ONE Championship. Yeah, I said ONE FC, that's their old name. You know, the officials are employees of them, and so they work for the promotion. That was the way it was long ago, like with the UFC and what I did. But it's changed. I work for athletic commissions, and my responsibility is to follow the rule set of that athletic commission. And that's a little bit different than what you're going to see when you're watching, you know, a show from Asia, one like ONE Championship.
So to set the scene, I know that ONE Championship doesn't have great worldwide television distribution, pretty much impossible to find outside of online. By the way, MMA-core.com does have this fight. It was pulled from YouTube for copyright restrictions. I'm just saying MMA-core.com, but let's set the scene.
I'm just saying, so, go watch there.
just saying. Askren and Santos, they're in the stand-up. 2 minute, 19-second mark of round number one. Askren moves inside for a body lock. Askren jams his left thumb into the right eye of Santos. Now, to me, it looked to be unintentional. Regardless, it was completely missed by the referee, Olivier Coste. He called time, but then weirdly ordered Santos to immediately stand up and resume fighting. So Coste, the French referee, calls time, but then tells Santos, no, you didn't get caught in the eye. From there, chaos just absolutely ensued. I've never met Olivier Coste. I felt bad for him. I actually felt embarrassed for him. I mean, he looked clueless.
You know, and it's, God dang it. It's one of those hard situations where I feel bad for him too. I really do. You know, it's, he's in over his head, but I don't know. I don't know any other way to say it. That's his fault. Everybody wants to be in that big fight. They're looking for that, oh, I want to do a world title fight. And, you know, sometimes I always say it, be careful what you wish for. Because when things go bad and you don't do the right things involved, everyone's going to look at you and you know, they're going to start saying terrible things about you, terrible things about your mother. The fact that you were born is a bad thing. And, you know, this is what comes with that responsibility. You know, you can look at Kenny Bayless is going to end up with the Pacquiao Mayweather fight come this weekend. And, you know, he's going to make a lot of money for it, more money than any referee has ever made for a combative sports engagement. And he deserves every red cent because the pressure that's going to come with everything that he does in that fight is immense. And it takes someone like Kenny to be able to handle that pressure and to do the job the way it's supposed to be done, being as fair as you can be to both guys in this incredibly huge fight. And, you know, when you don't know the rules and you don't know what you're allowed to do exactly, and you become overwhelmed and you start, you know, trying to fix your mistakes in the middle, you get the situation that we had with Ben Askren and Luis Santos, and it doesn't look good.
And we're not picking on Olivier Coste.
Well, people are going to say we're picking on him. I'm not trying to pick on him.
And we're not. And we're not. And that's not our intention. Look, John, you've made mistakes at the low levels of boxing, kickboxing, and Muay Thai that I've refereed. I've made plenty of mistakes. It happens. But our friend Rob Hines, I know one of his mantras when he teaches his MMA refs and judges seminars, especially for refs, look, if a mistake is made, you then have to control the narrative of what happens next. Otherwise, it's going to spiral out of control. Absolutely, this spiraled out of control. So Coste calls time, tells Santos to stand up or I'm going to end the fight. Santos is saying, no, I got poked in the eye. Coste then, with time still called, walks over, is now yelling for a replay to go on the screens in the Philippines to the audience, trying to judge not on a television monitor, but actually on the arena replay screens. Victor Cui, who's the CEO of ONE Championship, winds up coming onto the apron. Nobody knew what to do, was clear in that situation. Finally, Santos is given 5 minutes to recover. I never saw anybody that looked like a physician coming in. I saw somebody in a black polo shirt from ONE Championship. Maybe that's how the ringside or the cage side physician was attired. Is someone, John, who's commentated in MMA in 12 countries, including places like Bulgaria and the Spanish Canary Islands, I've seen some pretty crazy things. And that took me back to some of the things that I've seen when there wasn't a cage side physician. Nobody really knew what to do. People were looking around at each other.
Yeah, it was the cage side physician was in there. He was wearing a, you know, he's an employee of ONE Championship. He's wearing a black, you know, shirt that says ONE Championship on it. And he's trying to work with Santos, but Santos is not trying to work with him. And this is where you can look at the confusion that was going on. Ben Askren is walking all over the cage. He's making comments about he speaks English, you know, and the referee is saying, you know, he doesn't speak English. You know, you just look at the chaos that's going on. I get people all the time saying, you know, oh, you're so mean to fighters. You know, you're telling you, get over there. You know, it's no, I'm not mean to fighters. I control my cage. And that's what you saw not happening with what occurred in that fight is we didn't have a referee that was able to control anything. And when you don't have control, you have chaos, and that's what we had. And it doesn't look good. It looks bad for the sport. It looks bad for that organization. And, you know, we need to always be trying to do things in the most professional manner we can, but we can't have Ben Askren walking anywhere he wants inside of that cage. We can't have Santos sitting there communicating back and forth with his corner. His corner has nothing to do with this. I can tell you, I have refereed Luis Santos. He speaks English. Now,
yeah, I've interviewed him. He was in Bellator. He speaks English.
Yeah, not comfortably as, you know, as comfortably as, you know, you would think, you know, well, not as comfortably as you and I guess, but Mike Portuguese is weak, so he does speak English, so he understands everything that's being said there. But he keeps on, you know, trying to communicate because he's communicating with his corner. Well, again, this is where the referee needs to take control and understand where he's at, what he's got going on, and what he needs to do. And, you know, again, it's the amount of time and repetitions that a referee does something, you know, that makes them either good at something or bad at something. And when you don't have a lot of fights under your belt, and I don't think that, you know, the referee in that situation has a ton of fights under his belt, you know, it's going to make a difference in what occurs. And we need to always be working to improve our mechanics in taking care of a situation like that. When we have a fight that is stopped for, you know, it was stopped for an eye poke, it looked like. And then he basically said, no, 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 come here. And as soon as he's saying, come here, get down here, and the fighter's not doing it, this is where, well, let's see, who's in control of the fight? Is it the referee that's in control of the fight, or is it Luis Santos now that's in control of the fight? Because it's obviously not the referee. He's telling people to do things. It's not being done. And so then he's getting flustered and he's moving off and doing, you know, other things. And it just becomes a cluster. And it looks bad for the sport. It looks bad for one championship. And, you know, they're going to want to do that fight again. You know, I know I heard Ben saying, you know, things like, he was very upset that, you know, Luis Santos didn't go on. Luis Santos was doing a good job in the fight. You can, you know, it really doesn't matter what you saw for the first 2 minutes there as far as, you know, Ben was, you know, going for takedowns. He was getting stuffed. He was getting leg kicked. Luis Santos is doing good, but Ben is doing exactly what fighters want to do against Luis Santos, and that's pressure him and make him work because he tends to tire real quick, and then he just kind of, you know, falls off of the cliff. And I think that's, you know, Ben was pushing him towards that cliff's edge and he realized it. And, you know, he comes up with the thing of, well, you know, in wrestling, we had guys, we get poked all the time. And if we didn't continue on, we lost. You know, that's great. And I'm glad Ben, you know, remembers back to those days. But they weren't punching you in the face in wrestling either. You know, there's a big difference when you get an abrasion on your eye and you have someone punching at you or you're just grappling. And so, you know, to sit there and say that Luis Santos needed to go on in that fight, look at, if his eye, he can't see, if he has a corneal abrasion, he shouldn't be fighting. And I think his corner kind of, you know, put that in his mind and he went to that, you know, that decision when it came to when they wanted to get him back. But they should never have allowed 11 minutes, you know, 11 and a half, almost 12 minutes of time to go by before they made that decision. That's why under the unified rules, we have 5 minutes of time. Now, you could hear the referee and they're saying, oh, he's got 5 minutes. He's got 5 minutes. Well, it really doesn't matter what you say if you don't use it.
Well, and 5 minutes was put on after about 6 minutes of everyone exactly standing around. But, John, I've watched this video twice now online. I'm pretty certain that at one point Coase says the fight's over because he doesn't believe that Santos was poked in the eye. I think he's indicating he got shouldered in the eye, which is very bizarre. At one point, I believe that he says the fight's over, Askren wins by TKO, but then he tries to unring that bell. He did.
Absolutely. You know, I hate to say it that I've watched it, you know, twice also, so I'm a little sadistic because it's really hard to watch.
It is.
But he did. He made all kinds of decisions and reversed his decisions. And, you know, one of the main things as a referee, you got to make a decision and you got to go with it. And if you're wrong, then you admit to being wrong. And if we can, you know, adjust the fight and fix it the way it needs to be fixed, in the end, I will say at least the fight came out for what occurred the way it should have. Neither fighter won, neither fighter lost. We had a no contest. And if they want to come back and put that fight on again, they can come back and put that fight on again. I don't know if I'd really want to watch it because it's, you know, I've seen what's going to happen in the fight. And it's one of those that's for, you know, one championship to figure out. The real problem is they've got Ben Askren, who is a, you know, he's a talented guy.
He's phenomenal.
He's incredibly talented when it comes to his grappling. And it's going to be tough for other people to grapple with him. And the pressure that he brings, that he, you know, he created from the years of wrestling that, you know, he did, you know, coming up through high school into Missouri, into the U.S. Olympic team. He creates a pressure. He's got a style that's funky, you know, that's his name. But he's a guy that's in a limbo because he signed a long contract with a company that doesn't have anybody truthfully of his caliber for him to fight.
John, final point on this. Don't you think this big picture, the whole situation with Olivier Coste, with Victor Cui, the CEO of One Championship, trying to weigh in, trying to influence the decision, just all of the indecision, don't you think this exposes the dirty little secret in our sport that outside of the U.S. and Canada, a lot of promoters are judge and jury? You know, Olivier Coste, I read an online profile, I found it on Yahoo, said that he's fully employed since November 2013, is essentially a house referee, a staff referee by One Championship. They had him as an inspector, and he's worked his way up. But they're in the Philippines. They're outside of Manila. So One Championship, and I had this for 2 years when I was the M1 commentator. They're the promoter. They're the regulator. They're assigning the referees and the judges and the inspectors. They're controlling them. They're paying them. A lot of things are being mixed up together that we just take for granted are no longer mixed up in the U.S. and Canada under the ABC.
Yeah, you know, and this is what you get when you go outside of, you know, the U.S. You know, the truth is this. I think Victor Cui was just trying to fix what was going on in his show because – he's responsible for that show, and he wants, you know, he doesn't want this mess, you know, and he's trying to do what he can to try to correct the, you know, what's going on, and really there was nothing for him to correct. So I don't put any blame, you know, in his corner. I don't think he was trying to alter things. I don't think he's trying to, you know, cheat for anyone. I think he's trying to just correct a bad situation. But, you know, you can go back to, and, you know, you worked for Pride. And, you know, I loved Pride, but there was a ton of fights in Pride that were basically pro wrestling matches. They had a, you know, thought of outcome before the fight, you know.
They were works.
Ever happened.
We know.
They were works.
They were works.
Absolutely. And there was a lot of them. And, you know, that's a problem because when you have a show that people believe is real and you end up altering the outcomes of those fights, now we're talking about, you know, this is a, you know, this is as bad as, you know, as simple as it gets. This is where the mob comes in. This is where you have, you know, people altering and doing things and betting, you know, because they think it's real. And this is why you can't have, you know, things like organized crime as part of, you know, the shows. But in Asia, you know, it's hard for you to, you know, get away from that when it comes to the fighting world. And, you know, Victor Cui is going to have to try to work his, you know, way through that minefield that's there in, you know, the area that he's working his show. But it's not an easy thing.
Next week here on Let's Get It On, John and I will be joined by the great Teddy Atlas of ESPN to recap and review Floyd Mayweather Jr. versus Manny Pacquiao, which is without question the most hyped and buzzed about fight in boxing this decade. Now, earlier this week, one of my favorite websites, Awful Announcing, gave their picks for boxing's biggest fights of each decade dating back to the 1910s. And John, you know that I am such a boxing history nerd. I could talk on this program, probably you could too, about Jim Mace versus Tom King in 1862. But for the sake of time on our program, also for the sake of people who don't want to be bogged down in old, old school boxing history, let's you and me give our picks for boxing's fight of the decade, starting with the 1960s. And just to make it clear, we're talking about fights that impact boxing, sports, and popular culture coming in rather than exiting, such as Mike Tyson versus Buster Douglas in 1990. That fight had virtually no hype before, but afterwards it became hugely significant because Douglas knocked out Mike Tyson. So let's start with the 1960s.
Yeah, no one wanted to watch it back when it was going to take place. He was a 42-1 underdog. 42-1.
And had Tyson knocked him out in two rounds, it would have been just another Mike Tyson win. But that became significant after. So let's talk about the buzzed about, the hyped about fights, starting with the 60s. Do you want to go first or shall I? And we don't know what each other is going to say. So this isn't a work here. This is a full-on shoot.
This is a definite shoot here. You know, all right, let's hear. You go the 60s, I'll go the 70s, you go the 80s, and we'll go back and forth and, you know, see if we match up.
1960s, I'm going with Ollie Liston II, 1965, Lewiston, Maine. Now, it's been lost to history. The first fight, 1964 in Miami Beach, they couldn't even sell out the Miami Beach Convention Center. Liston was seen as unbeatable. Ollie was seen as this skinny kid who won an Olympic gold medal. But he just didn't have the power at heavyweight to transition from the amateurs to the pros. He was a media sensation. He was a joke. Liston was going to kill him. That's why it didn't sell out. A year later, with Ali scoring that massive upset, all the talk about Liston, is the mob involved? There was so much buzz. It permeated the culture. I think that was the most hyped about fight of the 1960s.
You know what? That's a pretty good one. I kind of like that. But I'm going to go with one of the same fighters. I think Sonny Liston against Floyd Patterson.
That's a good one.
Probably one of the biggest hype fights from the 60s, if you're going to look at what occurred, because, you know, at the time, Floyd Patterson was he was the youngest heavyweight champion until Mike Tyson took that from him, but he was the youngest heavyweight champion at the time. He ended up losing his title, lost it to Ingemar Johansson, ended up coming back and knocking out Ingemar Johansson so violently that Ingemar Johansson's foot was doing the shake. People thought he died. That fight with Sonny Liston, there was so much hype behind it because Sonny Liston was known to be a mob fighter. I hate to say it like that, but he was, you know, kind of owned by the mob. And Sonny Liston was, you know, they called him the Bear, and he was this guy that he scared people. He had this huge left hook, and he would go after people, and he was knocking everybody out. No one wanted to fight him. He was kind of like the Clubber Lang. You go back to, you know, the Rockies.
Yep.
You know, go back to Rocky III and Clubber Lang, the way, you know, Mr. T. That was Sonny Liston. You know, he scared everyone, and then he ends up just destroying, you know, Floyd Patterson. So the fight really didn't turn out to be as good as the hype behind it, because it was the real hype of the big, strong, heavy hitter against the technical boxer, you know, coming from, you know, Customato and the peekaboo style that Floyd Patterson was. I'm going with that was probably in the 60s. That's probably my number one.
And you're up for the 1970s. And I just have a feeling we're going to agree.
I got you on this one, but I'm taking it.
I think we're going to agree here.
Yeah. You know, the 70s, it's easy. You know, of all the fights, 1971, March 8th of 1971, Ali versus Frazier.
Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep, absolutely.
I mean, it was, because, you know, Ali was just coming back. You know, he was the champion. He had won it from Liston. He didn't lose it to anybody in the ring. He was undefeated. Joe Frazier being, you know, the Olympic gold medalist also. Coming in, you know, taking over the heavyweight division, you know, putting down, you know, Jimmy Ellis and different guys. And it was the two, you know, best heavyweights there were at the time. Joe Frazier, you know, known for his huge left hook, and Ali being the guy that no one could hurt, you know. Yeah, it's just that was an incredible hype. And then the fight matched the hype. And so 1970, the greatest hype fight, and, you know, probably the biggest hype fight of all time up until what we're coming up with is Ali versus Frazier 1.
So we're fully agreed there. 1980s, I'm going with Leonard versus Hearns 1, 1981. And let me set the scene. So this is to unify the WBC and WBA welterweight belts. two champions. Hearns is undefeated. Leonard has one loss, which he had avenged in the No Moss fight, the rematch versus Roberto Duran. Ali was phasing out. He wasn't retired yet, but he was phasing out. Leonard, you could say, was the biggest star by a long, long way in boxing. Leonard versus Hearns won. It was a spectacular fight, but again, that's moot to this argument. There was so much glamour, so much hype going into this fight. It's maybe, to me, post-World War II, and until what we're heading into now with Pacquiao and Mayweather Jr., the most hyped non-heavyweight fight post-World War II. But do you agree?
You know what? There was a ton of hype behind that fight, but I've got to go with the one that I don't think most people think about, but there was an incredible amount of hype. But it was when Larry Holmes was going to fight Jerry Cooney.
Oh, 1984. That's great. Yeah. That's great. Yep.
You know,
great white hope, Jerry Cooney.
Yeah. Well, maybe it was 1982, I think. Yeah, 82. And there was so much hype because, you know, at the time, Larry Holmes, and you know, he crushed Ali in, you know, 1980, and there was really nobody that was able to, you know, just be in the ring with him. His piston-like jab was killing everybody, and Jerry Cooney was the, you know, he was the white hope. You know, I hate that freaking, I hate that whole connotation because it's ridiculous.
But they sold the fight that way, didn't they?
Yes, they did, and you know, and that's fine. But you know, he had done some really good stuff. He had, you know, he had beaten you know, guys that were really doing well at the time. He took out Jimmy Young. He took out Ron Lyle. He took out Ken Norton. And, I mean, he hit Ken Norton with, you know, an incredible shot that, you know, knocked Ken Norton out. He was known for, again, this big left hook. And people really looked at it like he was going to be able to beat Larry Holmes. And the hype behind that fight was huge. And it was a good fight, but, you know, Larry Holmes just wore him out. And, you know, at the time, Jerry Cooney was undefeated. And that would probably be my biggest hype fight for the 80s.
1990s, John?
Oh, 1990s. You know, it comes between two, and both of them involve Mike Tyson. I got to go with probably Evander Holyfield, Tyson 2.
See, I have Tyson Holyfield 1, but you go ahead.
Okay, and it could be Michael Spinks against Tyson is another one that was hyped huge because Michael Spinks was the guy that took, you know, Larry Holmes off of his undefeated streak and beat him twice, and everyone was saying, you know, Michael was this odd fighter as far as he was a light heavyweight coming up in weight, but he was very difficult to, you know, fight against, and you know, just hit people from odd angles, and there was a lot of hype behind the fact that he was going to be able to, you know, beat Tyson. That didn't happen. You know, Tyson knocked him out in like 91 seconds. I mean, really knocked him out. But the multiple hypes behind Tyson and Holyfield in that they were supposed to fight and then it didn't happen. And then they end up fighting and, you know, Holyfield beats him, you know, soundly. But there was all this, you know, backstory of, oh my God, well, Tyson had this to deal with and this and that. And when he was coming back for real. And the hype behind that was just incredible. And so I'm going with Tyson Holyfield 2.
The reason I put Tyson Holyfield 1 is Tyson was undefeated coming out of prison. Holyfield was seen as washed up.
No, stop right there.
You don't think he was undefeated?
He had already been beaten by Buster Douglas.
Undefeated out of prison. He was 3-0. Post prison.
He Kevin was, McNeely.
That's exactly right. And Bruce Seldon, which a lot of people thought was a worked fight, but I think Seldon just.
I think he just
didn't like being punched in the head. But exactly. Tyson was 3-0. It was probably 5 to 6 years too late. Holyfield was seen as past it, but there was still so much buzz because you can make the argument that Tyson was maybe the most famous athlete in the United States at that time. Holyfield had been a great champion. He was coming off of his loss to Riddick Bowe. Maybe Tyson Holyfield 2 was bigger, but to me that was almost like a circus, like a sideshow, which became the ear bite fight. So I don't know, maybe history tarnishes that a little bit, but Mitch Halpern was the referee, the late Mitch Halpern. Tyson Holyfield 1. My great friend Mills Lane did number 2, of course, but there was just that buzz and the unpredictability of number 1. Because Tyson had been pretty soundly beaten by Holyfield going into the second fight, to me maybe the luster was off a little bit, but I don't know. I'm flip a coin. I could go with 1 or 2 on that, John.
Yeah, it's a good question, but all right, let's hear 2000.
Is this you or me?
No, this is me. This is 2000 to 2010. Is that where we're going?
Exactly. One still knows what to call this decade. So we'll say the first decade of the 21st century, the aughts maybe. I don't know what it's called. Mayweather versus De La Hoya 2007, combined 2.4 million pay-per-view buys in the U.S. and Canada. Now, entering Mayweather versus Pacquiao, that still stands as the record. I'm not even sure if there's a close second. Maybe you have one, but to me, that's the glamour fight of the previous decade.
Now you took the one that I was going to pick.
I don't really know what else one could pick, really.
There was so much hype behind, you know, the thing about Oscar De La Hoya was, you know, he made people believe, and he had that, you know, the golden boy, you know, persona from the Olympics and stuff. But, you know, he just made people believe, and, you know, he had won so many different, you know, fights and championships. And there was always times when I always, you know, kind of doubted him at times. And then he would prove me so wrong. And even I thought, you know what, he's got a chance of beating Floyd. You know, Floyd really, you know, made that mark, and people started to really understand how good he was when he destroyed Arturo Gatti. That was the one that made everyone realize, hey, this guy's good. Gatti couldn't hit him. And, you know, Arturo Gatti had made a living on being a warrior and going after people, and Floyd just beat him down. And that fight, the hype behind De La Hoya and Mayweather, it was huge. That has to be for the first part of 2000. That's the one.
We want to give credit to Tim Starks, who thought of this idea. His article is up, awfulannouncing.com. We will link it on our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. If we see a good idea, John, we're going to rip it off. That's just the way we roll here, right?
Oh, yeah. John, I tell everyone all the time, man, you know what? You like something I do, you know, something I say, take it, steal it, make it your own. That's what I'm going to do to everyone else, too.
We're going to talk a lot about Mayweather versus Pacquiao next week. But final word from you, John, do you think that this fight is going to live up to the hype?
I personally believe it's going to be a good fight. I really do. I think that Manny, for a guy that's been in so many big fights, I think he's got something that he wants to prove in this one beyond what has been the norm. And I think that, you know, in my opinion, I think he's going to go after Floyd in the beginning. I think Floyd is going to have a hard time just based upon the southpaw style. He's going to have to get used to Manny's odd footwork and what Manny does as far as jumping in and throwing shots. You know, most guys don't jump in on Floyd. You know, they tend to be fairly cautious and try to use the feints to set themselves up coming in. And I think Manny's going to go after him. I think for the first 5-6 rounds, I think you're going to see Floyd trying to figure Manny out. And, you know, obviously Floyd is a phenomenal defensive boxer. I think he's going to give Manny problems, you know, as far as, you know, I think he's going to thwart a lot of what Manny does, but I think Manny's going to go after him. And I think it's going to be that second half of this, match that's going to determine the winner of it. I think for the most part, I really do think Manny's going to take a little bit of a lead on Floyd. But I think in the end, Floyd's going to start to come back after figuring out how to stop what Manny's doing. And I think it's going to be a good fight. I think it's two great fighters. And if you put two great fighters together, most of the time, you're going to get at least a good fight. You may not get that great fight, but you'll get that good fight. And I think it's going to be a good fight.
John and I are back with you next week for an all-new episode of Let's Get It On, first available on Friday. Our guest will be the always outstanding and always outspoken Teddy Atlas of ESPN to recap and review the fight of this decade, Floyd Mayweather Jr. versus Manny Pacquiao. Remember, download and subscribe to our podcast on the iTunes Store. And for Android, download the Stitcher app and subscribe. Of course, you can go straight to our website to listen and subscribe, letsgetitonpodcast.com. You can also find us on social media, facebook.com/letsgetitonpodcast, and on Twitter, @podcastmma for this show, and for us personally, @JohnMcCarthyMMA and @SeanWheelock. Remember to ask us a question, make a comment, or inquire about becoming a sponsor of Let's Get It On. Email us directly at info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. One more time, that is info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Remember, please help us spread the word. Our goal is to be the number one podcast in combat sports. For John McCarthy, our producer Chris Lakin, and our entire crew, I'm Sean Wheelock. Thanks for listening, everyone. This has been a presentation of Ignotainment Media Network, online at ignotainment.com.
Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock, only on the Ignotainment Media Network. Don't forget to leave a rating and review in the comments section of the iTunes podcast store. If you have questions, comments, or are interested in sponsoring the show, contact us at info@letsgetitonpodcast.com or check out our additional lineup of podcasts, including Ocho Man, Behind the Eight Ball, The Whiskey Philosopher, and Youth Baseball Talk at ignotainment.com.